Welcome to the Finding Backcountry Podcast with your host, Dustin Whitwer.
I am Dustin Whitwer, and this is the Finding Backcountry Podcast. Follow along on my journey of learning from the best backcountry hunters each week as we explore valuable information I use to find success in the backcountry. Let's get to the show. This is the Finding Backcountry Podcast, episode number 13 with Dave Barnett. Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing excellent, man. How about yourself?
Good, good. We were just talking. This is round two. We tried last night. I was on the road for my day job and was staying at the hotel down in Vegas, and the internet connection was poor at best. And so we, after about four or five drops and dead spots in the audio, we decided to just scratch it and go the next night tonight. And so here we are, which is good. This is a topic that, I think we both need to be prepared for and just have some good input and good insight and lay out the facts and stuff. So, talk real quick, Dave, about just kind of your background growing up and, how you got into hunting and kind of just that brief story.
Yeah. So, obviously you guys caught my name, Dave Barnett. I was born in Northern Idaho, and I spent my childhood growing up both there and in Western Montana. Growing up, I pretty much just like everybody else, my dad was definitely my biggest influence as far as hunting. Real big archer. I think by the time I was two, I had my first self bow. I had a U longbow. So I've been shooting bows for a long, long time. So we hunted kind of everything there was available. Deer, elk, bear was kind of our main things we went after. After high school, I moved to Missoula, Montana, which is kind of central west portion of the state, and kind of got into the archery industry, managed a pro shop for a few years, and I'm currently the archery manager for Sportsman's Warehouse here in town. So we've been, focusing a lot on the archery game. The last couple of years, just with more or less my backcountry game getting a little bit stronger and kind of get more comfortable doing some more adventure hunts. Definitely kind of just more started going the route of whatever weapons open, that's what I'm hunting with.
Yeah. What is your backcountry? What's maybe your favorite backcountry hunt that you've been on?
Man, tough call. I really enjoy spring bear hunting. And I think more so just from the aspect of it's such a big glassing game. And it's just a cool time of the year to be out. I don't necessarily enjoy, I guess, hunting them as much as like deer and elk. But lately, the last couple of years, I've been really getting into late season mountain mule deer.
Late season with your bow, or is that rifle?
With rifle, yeah, during the rut.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that there in Montana lets you hunt them pretty late, don't they?
Yeah, we're actually one of the few states where on the general tag, we can hunt mule deer through the rut.
A lot of competition for that.
Yeah, there can be. You get more kind of the metro type areas like where we are. There's definitely a lot of hunters, but at the same point, you pick kind of some cruddy areas to get into, and it's usually not too hard to distance yourself.
Yeah. Those type of hunts, you staying overnight that late in the year or packing in and out every day, or what are you doing?
Generally later, packing in and out every day. I've been playing, getting into the floorless teepee game. And starting to play with stoves and that kind of thing. So it's definitely next on my agenda is doing more late season overnighters.
We just, I don't know if you saw on our Instagram stories or whatever, we actually just got a Kafaru, the 8-man with a medium stove. And man, I've been so impressed with that. I've not ever been a huge fan of floorless shelters. But we've recently started hunting later season hunts a lot more. And, the problems that I had with floorless shelters was, the early August bow hunts that we go on in Nevada, You know, you're dealing with spiders, and we had problems with water running through the
Right.
running through your tent. You got the bugs, and just, you know, it can it's just different. It's, you know, it's not a big deal. Toughen up, and you can deal with spiders and all that kind of stuff. But man, we set that thing up in the backyard the first first night, and got the little stove ripping, and we set it up, and it's been I've been impressed. You know, especially for the relative amount of size compared to the weight, I think it weighs with the medium stove, I think is about, well, the shipped weight that I was tracking, the tracking was like 16 pounds. So I think, you know, minus the box and some of the little instructions and extra things they throw in, I think it's probably around 14 pounds. You know, which could easily handle four guys with gear. If it needed to, you know, and still be running a stove and everything, so.
Yeah, they're definitely a big game changer. I've been using a two-man called the Silvertip from Seek Outside. I do a lot of solo hunting, so I kind of went real minimalistic type, you know. On that one, I think packed weight, I think I'm 26 ounces on it, and then I use
Jeez.
a trekking pole to pitch it, you know. So all said and done, sleep system, not counting a stove, you know, shelter and bag and pad and all that, I'm just a hair over 5 pounds.
Does that have a stove option on that small of a tent or no?
Yeah, you can either buy them with a stove jack or without, and then you know, kind of go from there.
Yeah. Well, I know that I stayed in it. My wife and I actually slept in it that first night. It was up, and it actually, for down here in Southern Nevada, it got, you know, down in the upper 30s, relatively cold for this time of year, but and I had a couple pretty good sized little logs to throw in there, and it was that medium stove. It was chewing those logs up pretty quick. You know, it was probably a 2 hour burn down time or so. You know, I'd wake up every couple hours or so, and it'd be out, and I'd have to restoke it. But still, I mean, if you had two or three guys in there in a snowstorm, I'm sure it wouldn't be a problem to wake up and keep that thing going to not freeze.
Right, yeah, just that's a big morale booster there.
Yeah. Well, fun, man. Yeah, Montana's one of those states that us Southerners, we always look up at and think, man, that's, you know, that'd be fun to go hunt up in that country. And it's so far. You know, we end up stopping along the way. We end up stopping in Utah or Colorado or Wyoming or even Idaho before we get to Montana. So,
Yeah, you definitely kind of hit the almost like the grass is greener on the other side mentality, where you're driving through so much good country to get here.
yeah, it's almost got to be on your list. And I know they're pretty liberal with tags. They have like a don't they have a general they have like a quota and then a general season. And is the general season, is it over the counter or is it?
Yeah, so kind of how that works, just real quick, residents essentially, we have for the most part over the counter everything, you know, and obviously we do have permit draws for some of the trophy units and whatnot.
And that's for like
Now, not,
that's like all three species, right? Like deer, antelope, elk. Is that right?
yeah, so deer and elk and bear we can buy on over the counter, mountain lion in some areas. Antelope you have to draw, but there's so many tags. I mean, your odds of a resident as a resident of drawing, you know, some type of antelope tag are pretty high. Now, non-residents do have to draw our deer and elk tags, considered a permit at that point. You know, and just up until last year is a guaranteed draw. We have leftovers all the time. This last year, we did have some leftovers, but they were very few and far between. And any leftovers that were available sold out fast. You know, so I mean, we're still, you know, you're probably still in that 85 to 90% draw rate for non-residents. But yeah, you do have to buy permits in order to get into it.
And we'll move on to, you know, kind of the topic at hand here, but real just while we've covered that much, when is the just with application season coming up, when is Montana deadline? I've never actually applied for it. Do you know when the
Yeah, so March 15th is the big deadline for deer and elk applications. So that's the time when residents have to put in for their special draw tags, and then non-residents have to put in for first A, their tags, and then B, they'll also put in for any secondary draws for permits that they'd like to do past that.
Okay, good deal. All right, good deal, man. Well, we'll get into the real reason. I always like to, you know, if you've got some information on a state or something, then that's good to get out there regardless of what we're talking about. But you know, the real reason that we were sitting down tonight to talk about this is I had read an article, you know, a week ago or a couple weeks ago or whenever it came out, that you had written on Go Hunt, and just so maybe just briefly talk about what that article entails and kind of what we're, well, let's back up, start with just kind of how you got into, I'm curious about how you got into writing, you know, kind of how, what, where did that passion come from, and what's your background on writing and stuff like that in the hunting world?
Yeah, so I've never had, I guess, any, like, you know, formal writing, you know, as far as jobs or training or anything like that. It was always something I kind of liked doing through school, you know, just reports and you know, writing papers, that kind of thing. So I was kind of been interested in as far as converting that over to the hunting side of things. Brady Miller, the digital content manager for Go Hunt, I've known him for, I don't know, probably 4 or 5 years, somewhere in there, a few years before he went to Go Hunt. And so we've kind of kept in contact over the years. But a couple of years ago, hunting partner and I had a pretty awesome bow season. And Brady had contacted me about writing an article on a hunt where I had killed a pretty nice bull here in Montana.
Yeah.
And when he had submitted that, and kind of just kept in contact, and he started pitching me a couple ideas and some articles I needed to help with. So I decided to throw a few together and, you know, just see what they thought. And it just kind of went from there. Up to this point, I've written a lot of articles from them. We kind of range all over the spectrum from real techie, you know, number driven type stuff to, you know, real basic, you know, bow tuning articles and kind of whatever in between there.
What's, I mean, you obviously enjoy it. What's maybe your favorite article that you've ever written?
Oh man, that's not a tough one. yeah, this one, it's kind of getting there. It was a big taboo thing. You know, but the more I dug into it, it really took me for a trip, you know, as far as there's a lot of stuff that wasn't totally apparent from the get go. But I don't know, my favorite, probably, I wrote one, my wife and I had our first kid this last, August, about a year and a half ago. And, I wrote an article on kind of how to juggle a newborn baby and family life, you know, while still trying to hunt as much as we would like to.
Real stuff. That's the stuff we should be talking about.
Yeah, that was definitely a fun one. You know, that was something, I know when I found out that her due date was September 11th.
Oh no.
Yeah, I definitely had kind of a mini heart attack. You know, bless her heart, my daughter decided to come in August, so she didn't come in September, but
that's gonna be your daughter's gonna be an elk hunter. That's what that means.
Right, exactly. <She knows. laughs> Yeah, I mean, ended up having one of the better seasons I've had in recent years, and you know, it wasn't near as doomed as I thought it was going to be. You know, once you get through it, you know, I think you have so many preconceived notions there, but yeah. it was a lot different than I expected.
Yeah. Well, so the article that we're referring to, that's, you know, I guess we'll say controversial or, you know, a hot subject, is, the one that I came across, and that was, the selling of big game animal locations through these apps or services. Why don't you, you know, with just that title, introduction, why don't you just give a kind of a little briefing here on what we're talking about and what these apps generally are and what's going on?
Yeah, so I don't know, it's probably maybe 3-4 weeks ago, I stumbled upon this advertisement for an app. Basically, what this app allows users to do is download it, log on to this app, and you can buy or sell the locations of big game animals. You know, with these zaps, I did a little bit of looking into them. Prices on animals were varying anywhere from $100 to $600. I'm not sure, you know, what they're using to set the standard on that, or if it's just set by the user. But also within these apps, outfitters can actually advertise landowner tags they might be trying to outfit for, or just outfitted hunts. They pay kind of a little fee on there on top of it. But basically, kind of the main thing that we were talking about and wanting to discuss was the ability for anybody to find a, you know, say a trophy quality bull or buck or what have you, take a picture of the thing and mark its GPS location, and then sell those coordinates to somebody that would like to go after it.
So the outfitter, though, they're just advertising, hey, we're, so are they link, the outfitter's probably linking to advertisements for animals in their area, right? Is that what I'm guessing? And saying, oh, this deer's been posted up in, you know, eastern Utah, and we're an outfitter in eastern Utah for this area. We also have landowner tags available, so it's kind of a like an all-inclusive purchase. You can buy your tag, choose your outfitter, and then pick out your deer, kind of a thing. Like, is it?
I think to an extent. I mean, you had to get on the app, actually download the app, and which I probably should have just in order to check it all out. But you know, I don't know if it was something where a guy would have an option to, you know, purchase a, you know, say a whatever 330-inch bull in Region G of Wyoming, you know, and then turn around and find, you know, kind of the certified outfitters through this app on there they could also, you know, purchase through.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was some on there as far as, you know, there were cancellation hunts they were trying to fill. And then also landowners selling their landowner tags as well.
That's like the Walmart of the hunting world. You know, we have we've got everything you need, you know, just start with toiletries and work your way around to the dog food section and hit up the electronics on your way to the food, and then stop and, you know, grab some clothes and check out, you know, right. Everything you need for a 200-inch deer. Okay. So if people understand, I mean, we've got these couple apps that have come out there. There's actually two different apps, right?
Yeah.
One, I've made a note here. One is kind of more selling the actual trail camera pictures. So they've got, it seems like, a team of hunters, you know, out and about setting up who knows how many trail cameras.
Right.
I don't know, but I know that they advertise on their and I'm going to stay pretty neutral as far as I'm not definitely not looking to advertise for these companies any more than we already are going to by running a podcast
right.
on it. Unfortunately, that's just what people are going to do. That you can, you know, this isn't the 1950s where you'd be listening to this on a radio and you wouldn't have any clue how to figure out what we're talking about. You can pop into Google or social media and figure this out on your own, but I'm probably not going to say it out of my mouth. But so there's right. one service that is a trail camera service, selling the GPS locations, and that they actually, and they advertise per their website or whatever, they're claiming that they are uploading 1,000, they're taking 10,000 trail camera pictures a day, and that equates to 1,000 like quality, actual, the way I understood it was actual images of, you know, big game per day, 1,000 per day across,
that's, you know, incredible.
So many states in the West. And so that one seemed to me like a, is that how you understood it? Where that's like a membership that you buy into, and then you have access, the same access that everyone else has. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. From what I understood. Yeah. It pretty much seems like you kind of entered your search criteria as far as species or location or whatever,
right.
And start shopping.
And then the other one that I think your article is more centered around, and they kind of go hand in hand, but was more selling actual pictures of big game, or in the case of like a mountain lion, guys were selling, you know, you're out in the hills and you cut a lion track, in the snow or whatever, and you're selling that location. So that's more of like you're physically there, you're personally taking a picture. And then the difference too was that is it almost like an auction, or is it like a bid, or is it a, you know, what do you know what format those are being sold in?
From that one, what I gathered was they just kind of had buy it nows on it. You know, I couldn't figure out as far as what dictated, you know, the pricing on there. You know, unless it was just user created, you know, and the guy kind of decided what he thought that deer was worth or what.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, are you crazy? You think you're going to get more than $10 for a forked horn in Utah? you'd probably be surprised. You'd probably be surprised what a what a good solid, I mean, we're talking a good meaty, not a 1.5 year old, but a 2.5 year old forked horn would go for in the state of Utah, especially if, well, never mind. Anyway, I won't go there. It's all good. Nothing against Utah. I just happen to hunt in Utah, so I can say that. But all right. So where do we go from here? So you write this article, and was it your idea to write it? Was somebody at Go Hunt, or how did that start?
It honestly started out as a screenshot that I'd sent to Brady, basically saying like, hey, did you see this thing?
Yeah, check this out.
You know, cause that was kind of when it first blew up on social media, and, you know, on Facebook and Instagram there. I mean, it was kind of all over the place.
That explains, I know Brady, and he's probably like, oh yeah, I wonder, you know, how much I'm going to have to pay for a 200 incher in Nevada this year. That's probably what Brady's thinking, I'll bet.
I think probably backdoor. That's what he's looking at.
Yeah, right. Brady don't need help. Brady don't need help from anybody in Nevada. That sucker, he knows how to knock him down. But okay. So you screenshot to Brady and, at Go Hunt, and you guys kind of like, man, this needs to be out there. So you write it. What was the initial reaction like on Go Hunt?
Yeah. So, I mean, like when I first set out on this whole thing, you know, I had probably the same reaction that I'll say 99% of the other hunters that I've seen so far that have had to it, you know, which was essentially was heck no. Yeah. We're not going to do this. The more and more I started digging into it, there's things that I discovered, you know, that essentially if I said, no, we can't do this, I was almost having to say no to other aspects of the hunting industry too.
What do you mean? You know, it's certainly elaborate on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the big thing, and we kind of touched on it yesterday, was with guides and outfitters. You know, I mean, on one hand, you have a guy that's paying several thousand dollars or whatever to go out and hunt this animal and experience kind of Western hunting. You know, on the other hand, you have a guy that can show up and, you know, whatever, just spend $500, you know, by location of an animal. And let's just say hypothetically the animal stays in the same position. You know, he can drive out and shoot it now for a fraction of the cost. When you get into the guiding and outfitting world, you know, I mean, we could spend all day talking about it, but there's a lot of stuff that guys agree with and guys don't agree with it.
Yeah.
You know, primarily the main thing you start looking at, you know, some of these guys that might be dealing with governor's tags and auction tags or whatnot, you know, and you start talking 230, 240 inch mule deer that a guy has lived with for a month, you know, anticipating a hunter coming in that spent 50 grand to kill that animal.
Yeah.
You know, where do you draw the line between that and a guy buying the location of that animal?
Right. And, you know, and having, and I mentioned this to you yesterday, having personally guided hunts, I don't anymore, and I haven't for years. Having grown up in a family that ran a guided hunting business, for years and years, guides earn every dollar that they make, I believe. Mm-hmm. Guides don't live an easy life. Guides, for the most part, and I'm speaking in generalities here, but generally speaking, guides flat out know how to hunt. They know how to get it done, and they know how to hunt, and they have a very, very skilled, very honed skill set. No different than in my opinion, it's no different than, you know, I don't know, someone that, you know, knows a sport, you know, archery, or someone that knows a, you know, a craft, a skill like plumbing or electrical work. And they've honed that skill to the point where, people are willing to pay them, you know, decent money, yeah, decent money to go out and, you know, benefit from their skill. And so just talk in your opinion about people's reaction on the guiding side of things compared to this. I mean, what are some of the differences that you see, or that people are, or the similarities that you see between guiding and something like this?
Yeah, I mean, that was undoubtedly going through the comments. That was like the big one. Like, everybody was saying, you know, how is this different than hiring a guide? You know, which, like you said, guides bust their ass, for lack of a better term. I mean, I got a few good buddies that either A, own their own businesses, or B, work for some very successful outfitters. And they're not doing easy hunts at all. It's stuff that, I mean, where they're taking clients in areas that are, you know, are going to be tougher than what most locals around here are used to. I mean, they're working hard for it. You know, I think, like I said, I think the primary difference there, well, one thing that I thought of quite a bit, you know, as far as looking from the aspect of somebody potentially looking to purchase locations versus an outfitted hunt, you know, like you talked about, these guys know the country they're hunting, they know the animals they're hunting, and they know how to do what they need to do to be successful. You know, and somebody say that might be coming out on a first time Western hunt, you know, they're really robbing themselves of future successes by, you know, foregoing the guiding option, or even the do-it-yourself option, as far as going through the hoops you have to find animals.
Yeah, it's kind of like hiring a mentor. You know, for some reason that's okay in every other aspect of life. You know, if I was, I was just talking to one of my coworkers today about real estate, and he paid a substantial amount of money to, you know, to hire a mentor, basically, to walk him through the process of how to buy and sell real estate, you know, which yes, is a kind of a money-making thing, but really it's his passion, and he doesn't know, you know, he just doesn't know how to do it, but he's very interested in it enough that, you know, he wants to hire a mentor. I don't know if that's the same thing. I don't know if it's not the same thing to me. You know, I think the correlation could probably be made. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. You know, whether a guy continues to, you know, use that outfitter in the future, or then, you know, at that point, you know, after a hunt decides that, you know, they kind of got the hang of it, or at least know kind of the steps they need to take, you know, they go that route.
Yeah. So one key difference, though, between an outfitter and this, I think that maybe people have, I don't know that I've seen, I've looked through quite a few comments, and I don't think I've seen many people touch on this. Outfitters talk about the licensing and the fees and the, you know, the all the licenses that an outfitter goes through compared to something like this.
Right. Yeah. So that was one that I've seen a few guys, but it really didn't get brought up that much. I kind of hit on it a little bit in the article, where basically, you know, anybody that is selling the locations of animals and you know, making money off it, they're basically profiting off of a public resource, while not having to contribute anything back into the wildlife agencies or the animals themselves. You know, you look at guides and outfitters, and you know, they're paying small fees, but they're paying fees and taxes and you know, everything else involved with the business, you know, that's then in turn going back into wildlife management programs. You know, and that was kind of one big thing that did bother me with it, is that essentially they're taking money from all of us and not paying their dues.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, an outfitter, just to give you an idea, in the state of Nevada, I know, you actually start, you can't just start in Nevada as a master guide, which is the, kind of the main, you know, you can't just open your own guiding business. You basically start as a sub guide under another master guide that will allow you to come and work under him. And I think it's like, I think it's 3 years. It depends on prior experience. I think if you, you know, came from Utah, for example, and had a 5 or 10, 20 years of guiding experience over there, it might be different. But if you were just starting fresh as a 20 something year old or whatever, and you wanted to get into guiding, you would spend 3 years basically apprenticing as a sub guide under a master guide, paying for a sub guide license or a master guide license once you get to that point, taking a test on all sorts of things, you know. And I understand that's different because you're actually out there hunting with someone, and you're quote unquote responsible for the actions of another hunter. But then, like you were hinting, you have to form an entity, a business, right? And that's where we're getting into the you know, paying your dues kind of thing. Everyone's forming a business license that they pay. And then the BLM or the Forest Service or whatever area of land that you're hunting on usually requires, I believe it's 3% of your gross sales to be paid as a, you know, as a fee or a tax or whatever for making money. And right. So do you think that's the answer? Do you think it's that simple? Do you think that if these scouting services or whatever we're calling them were to have to go through those same guidelines, do you think do you think that's reasonable to even pull off? And B, do you think that would alleviate a lot of the complaining or the negative aspect of this?
Yeah, I think you'd definitely see kind of the hating subsidized on it. You know, I think you're starting to see it just like you do, you know, as far as, you know, quote unquote DIY hunters towards the, you know, the outfitting crowd. But I think if there was some sort of, you know, licensing or certification established, you know, prior to somebody being able to sell these, I think you'd definitely see a, you know, a kickback a little bit as far as the negativity towards it.
Yeah, it's interesting to even think about because, you know, I think it would eliminate a lot of these, you know, freelance guys that are out running trail cameras or, you know, I call them freelance, quote unquote freelance guys that are out that are going to be out in the hills snapping, you know, phone scopes of a deer and then posting it up, because if, you know, if you had to go through the red tape, then all of a sudden, how many deer would you even have to, you know, be able to sell for it to be worth it? You know, if you were paying 3% of your gross income and then you had to go get a, you know, for a non-resident, I know for a non-resident, a guide and outfitter license in Nevada is like $1,500, I want to say, you know, maybe not that much, but it's relatively high. And so at what point, you know, would it even be worth it if you had to go through the same, requirements as a guide? And I don't know that that's even the right answer. Maybe something would have to be completely its own thing or something like that. But, I don't know.
I think,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that's probably something that'll need to be addressed. I mean, I don't know. I almost anticipate this app kind of probably fizzling out a little bit. I mean, just based on the public perception as of right now. I do think just with technology becoming the way that it is and how, you know, how dominant it is in our everyday life, I think you're going to see more and more of this. And I think it's something that's going to have to be addressed sooner rather than later, you know, from both the hunting community and from the state side.
I agree. Whether it's this app or not, I don't see things like this going away. Technology will continue to increase, and the capabilities of technology will continue to increase. And furthermore, and probably more importantly, laziness of just people in general will continue to increase by nature. That's the way the world's going. In fact, there's one, I want to read one comment that was made on my post today in regards to this. Cause I actually won't mention who it was. If people are interested, go see, you know, who it was to give them credit. Just more because I don't know if they would appreciate me rattling this off or not, but, quote, change is in the hands of the consumer. Unfortunately, we live in an era where laziness is far too common and swindlers run amok. If someone sees a shortcut, they are going to take it. And if someone can make money off of that shortcut, they are going to take full advantage of it. It will be interesting to see if this new trend amongst hunters, I hope not, but I think he meant to say, if I had to bet, I would bet on laziness. Too many times I see hunters being as lazy as they can from taking unethical shots at 800 yards just because they have a fancy scope, or driving ATVs off roads where it's not permitted, to using drones to spot and harass game. But thinking more about it, is there really that much different from buying coordinates for a big buck and buying apps that tell you where to hunt on private public land? That's a different topic. But anyway, I agree with the principle that, you know, unfortunately, if you had to bet on laziness, I would bet on laziness. And so whether it's these apps or the next one or the next one, I'm afraid this is something that we're going to see more and more of, and we're going to have to deal with. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, there's a lot in social media these days that I think creates a, you know, a false sense of success in the hunting industry. You know, we could touch on this a little bit more with the public perception, but, you know, I think you see a lot of new or young or, you know, whatever hunters getting into it. They're seeing all these animals the guys are killing, you know, and the problem with social media, you look at a trophy picture and, you know, all you see is the end result. You don't see what led up to that moment, you know, and there's such a pressure on people anymore to have to kill, you know, a big animal or you know, whatever, that guys are willing to some extreme lengths if they feel it's necessary to do that.
Yeah. Real quick, before we touch on the public perception, I want to go back and mention just one perspective on the guiding thing real quick. Because this is a point of view that I did not see. I wasn't seeing it from this point of view until I read through some comments. And so I believe that there's two sides to this controversy. There's the side where people are frustrated that someone is able to buy basically buy a big game that's for sale. But then there's another perspective where someone's making money off of it and not doing anything, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so the point that I want to touch on is that there was some people who seemed to be more frustrated, you know, with the comparison between guides and outfitters and an app like this. They were okay that someone was paying the money. They just weren't okay that someone wasn't physically offering a service. You know, there was no work necessarily being done like there is on a guided hunt, and that, you know, like we talked earlier, that the guides earn the physical, you know, they earn their paycheck. And that this is just somebody out, you know, and there was a whole argument about whether these images are even going to be credible, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And that's, you know, that's whatever, that is what it is. But
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, do you see it as another, you know, do you see it as kind of not as much like, oh, it's wrong to be paying for something, or do you see it as like, you know, I don't know. Does that make sense? You're not earning it because someone's not out in the field, you know, hiking the hills with you, to earn their money.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, the main thing I think a lot of guys, you know, probably understand, but, you know, aren't maybe not communicating, could be just getting lost in translation, but, You know, just because the guy's purchasing the location of this animal doesn't ensure that, you know, he's harvesting that animal.
Yeah.
You know, there still has to be some degree of relocating, you know, and then eventually successfully stalking or, you know, whatever method you use to take the animal from that point.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it, I think, from what I was read and kind of what I understood was, you know, guys saying that, you know, that's not a way to earn the animal, you know, be it through, you know, packing in so many miles or, you know, or some kind of a mental commitment to, you know, to the hunt over, you know, X amount of days or whatever. So I think that was a lot of the opposition there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, this is a fun one because it's just, it's so gray.
Right.
Yeah. You know, if you're frustrated that people are able to pay money and get something that they didn't earn, I hate to say this, but that is a guided hunt. You know, that's the definition of what people do when they go on a guided hunt. They're paying someone money for them to do work finding big game for them in its simplest
form.
If you're okay with that, you know, then I can almost understand if you're on the flip side, if it's a matter of, you know, the guide is earning that paycheck by taking you out, and actually it's okay that's happening. It's just that he's actually going out in the field with you rather than just, you know, uploading a picture onto the internet and then walking away. Then I can understand that too. I can understand both sides of it. Man, fun stuff.
Yeah.
Talk about back to the public perception. Mm-hmm. How do you feel this could be perceived by the public? Someone who maybe isn't a hunter.
Yeah. So the big thing that I look at there, you know, and it's becoming more and more apparent every day, is that, you know, obviously hunters make up a very small majority of the U.S. population. In fact, I think I read somewhere, and I could be totally off on this, but I think it was 10%, give or take.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part, I consider non-hunters and anti-hunters alike kind of holding the key to our future, so to speak. And a lot of that's going to be dictated in how we carry ourselves and, you know, and then also how we come together and fight for what we need to. You know, you look at in British Columbia recently with the grizzly bear hunts getting banned, you know, that's something, I mean, I can't say for sure, but that's something that's going to be very, very hard to get back and really open up the doors to more hunts potentially being taken away from us. You know, now, as far as with the app, you know, like we've talked about, there's a lot more to it than just simply buying the location of the animal. You know, now a guy has to, you know, acquire his tag if he doesn't have that, spend the time driving into the area, relocating the animal, you know, putting the stock on him and then eventually killing it. You know, but from an anti-hunter or non-hunter standpoint, they look at this as just, you know, these quote unquote slob hunters getting on and buying a trophy animal, yeah. You know, and that's the end of it.
Which to us is ironic, that they would care. Have you ever been to a livestock auction?
Yeah.
You know, right. I mean, the irony that an anti-hunter, you know, would look at, you know, even a guided hunt, that they would look at a guided hunt as saying, oh, you're just paying, you know, or an auction tag, that they would look at these tags and say, oh, you know, we can't believe that you're putting a price tag on these animals. You know, hunters who understand conservation, they understand, you know, that it's a resource. They understand that it's natural organic meat, you know, that we're bringing home to feed ourselves and our family. It's way more reputable than, you know, watching a heifer come through the chute at the auction, you know, and you know, and then just head right to the slaughterhouse. I mean, but that's not reality. You know, I don't know what,
yeah, I mean, yeah, it's easy to sit down with your buddies and, you know, justify a, you know, an auction tag or whatever. You know, but the simple fact of the matter is, you know, if you were to sit down with an anti-hunter, you know, in a room and try to explain, I mean, it's not going to go anywhere. You know, they've already have their preconceived notions before they even sit down with you.
Yeah.
You know, so they're going to see what they see, and we've all seen the, you know, the posts that they make on social media and whatnot, and they, you know, when they find somebody to kind of flog,
yeah.
They're definitely extreme, you know, to one end.
Well, and you know, 10 years ago, maybe, you know, we may have had the mentality that, well, they're anti-hunters. We're hunters, you know, we just stick to what we're doing and we don't care what they think. And, you know, they're just mad about what's going on and we don't care. We're going to keep doing what we think. Now, all of a sudden, grizzly bear hunting gets banned in British Columbia. And I'm telling you that it wasn't all of the hunters, you know, making that happen. It was probably people who don't understand hunting or who don't hunt. You know, that were the driving force behind most of that. And I don't know the details on that, but I think I understand the gist of the situation. You know, it was the public's perception that was given to the political leaders, so to speak, or their, you know, whether it was, I don't know, I'm not going to get into that, but the point is if we don't understand that how we interact within our hunting circle affects more than just the conversations that we have. It's bigger than that. Then I'm afraid we're in for a bigger fight than just us discussing what's, you know, what should or shouldn't happen within the hunting industry. We're in for a fight of should we even be allowed to hunt anymore or not.
Yeah, that's exactly true. You know, and that's one thing too, and I mentioned in the article that is a huge win for us. You know, you look at last year when I believe his name is Jason Chavez, representative that introduced that bill that would disposition 3 million acres, you know, of federally protected land. I mean, that's kind of what I think is when that Keep It Public hashtag kind of came about, or at least made it its, you know, its kind of debut appearance. You know, in a relatively short amount of time, we got that bill completely revoked.
Right.
You know, to the point where he withdrew it. Now, that was a pretty incredible thing to see blow up that fast. And you know, a lot of our bigger names, so to speak, in the industry that backed it and got on board.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing. I mean, and I'm as guilty of it as the next guy, you know, when you get with your buddies and start, you know, ribbing on some picture some guy posted with a buck that he killed. You know, but it's, you know, we do need to stick together in this day and age. You know, we're losing rights. We're not necessarily gaining rights, and it's time to kind of plug up the holes and go into self-preservation mode and start thinking about what we're doing, because we're advertising to a lot bigger audience than we think we are.
Yeah. Two really good points there. One, the outside of the hunting industry has a lot more power than I think we want to admit on the future of hunting, and more, probably more importantly, us as hunters, when united, have more power than we probably realize to preserve the right to hunt. So, well,
yeah, that's exactly true.
You know, I don't know if you saw this, but I've been trying to get Cameron Haynes on the podcast for quite a while. Conveniently, yesterday I saw him post a post that he has now been appointed as a member of the International Wildlife Conservation Council, representing the interests of archery and or hunting sports industry. His appointment is for a two-year term, effective the date of this letter. And that is signed by the Secretary of the Interior. So we need to, let's all push. I think we would all appreciate to have Cameron Haynes on here. So let's just send him a big old nudge. Everyone who listens to this, and let's get his ambassador of the hunting industry relative to politics and stuff. We want to get, his
absolutely. In. Sorry to interrupt you. That's a huge win for hunters.
Yeah. Yeah. We need more of that. We need more guys like him, you know, that understand what's going on and have a presence and have the voice necessary, you know, to keep things headed in the right direction. So,
yeah.
Good.
Then,
go ahead.
Yeah, one thing I was going to say I did want to hit on before we get too far, because I spaced it and I told the guy on Instagram I was going to talk about it. In response to, or I shouldn't say totally in response to this particular app, but kind of in lieu of things like this becoming popular, this year there was a House bill introduced to Wyoming, House Bill number 0005.
That's right.
Where basically they outline in there that unless you're a guide or an outfitter, you cannot sell the location of an animal. You can't sell maps. You can't even sell pictures or drawings of the animals with the intent of the buyer going to kill that animal.
So do you know for sure that was, so if you're a licensed guide and outfitter, or
So as you read, as you read through it, they'll outline kind of first what you can't do, and then they do have allowances in there where essentially they dictate, you know, if you're an outfitter or a licensed guide, you know, and I don't know if it was total free range, like you can, you know, you can do it, or if you kind of have to be operating as the outfitting entity at the time of doing it or what have you.
Right.
But there is steps in place through Wyoming. It's just been introduced at this point. It hasn't gone to the House or nothing yet. So.
Yeah. Perfect, man. Well, and here's I'll give kind of my closing thoughts here, and then I want to turn it over to you and let you kind of wrap this up. After stewing on this for quite a few days, trying to define, you know, exactly where the line should be, so to speak. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid that it simply comes down to, you know, I don't want to call it ethical, but maybe a moral line in the sand where I just know when something doesn't feel right. Right. And to me, a guy that has earned his money and chooses to spend it hiring a guide or a mentor or whatever you want to call it, to be in the hills with him, to make sure that an animal gets taken ethically or properly and is properly taken care of, you know, that his accommodations are taken care of, that he's not going to go into the backcountry to bad situation or whatever the case is, or frankly, if he just wants to go hire someone that can help him kill a 200 inch deer or a 400 inch bull, for some reason that feels okay to me. That feels different than a guy posting up a picture of a deer with GPS locations, paying a subscription to see where that trail camera is, or, you know, paying to see where a buck or a bull was located. I don't know why, and I can't define where the difference is. That's just what I feel like inside as someone who's hunted their entire lives and kind of, you know, understands the feelings that I get when I go out into the hills and I, you know, and I do it the way that we do it. And, you know, and so I'm not here to tell anyone what they think. Do with the information what you will. You know, be respectful of others, be respectful of the situation and hunting in general, be respectful of the, you know, the opportunity that we have in front of us. So what do you have to add to that?
Yeah, I'm definitely along the same lines of what you're saying. You know, like I said, when I first started writing this article, you know, I was ready to sign up as the leader of the Pitchfork Army to go take this guy down. But the more I started reading into it and, you know, with talking to you yesterday, you know, just things got wheels turning a lot. You know, I don't think I can consciously say definitively that, you know, this will end up being any different than guiding. I guess to the extent that I wouldn't be comfortable saying that this should be illegal, whereas guiding should not.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much of it. There's a very broad gray line that we're walking right there. And really it's over just a couple minor things, you know, and like we talked about, you know, requiring some kind of licensing or certification or something to that extent for the app users, you know, could kind of solidify it a heck of a lot more, I think. I think the main thing I would say to anybody that's potentially considering, you know, using these services versus a guide would be just to consider that, you know, you're robbing yourself of a pretty cool experience of, you know, learning how to hunt an area, you know, the camaraderie of hanging out with your guide or outfitter, you know, and just experiencing the hunt in general. You know, past that, you know, I don't want to judge how anybody hunts or, you know, my way is better than anybody else's way or whatever. You know, but there, you know, as well as I do, there's no better feeling than, you know, finding an area on your own, locating an animal, you know, effectively killing an animal and then packing it out to the truck.
Yeah.
You know, it when you got a bad pack out, it sucks while you're doing it, but there's no greater feeling than dropping your last load on the tailgate.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Dave, you're no different than any other guest. So even though this has been a very specific topic, you still get the fire round of questions, man.
Perfect.
So we'll just blow through them. For archery hunting, mechanical or fixed blade broadhead?
Last couple years I've shot mechanical. I'm going to go back to six this year.
Any bad story or just?
Nope. Never had a bad experience. I've killed a few animals with mechanicals. It's just one of those things where I have more confidence in my fixed blade stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I'm at full draw and, you know, bull, bear, buck, whatever, you know, the last thing I want is to have any kind of sliver of doubt, you know, and that's just where I'm comfortable at. So that's what I'll end up shooting.
Best backcountry rifle caliber?
Oh man, that's a toughie. I shoot a 7 mag. I really like it. Definitely got some more recoil to it. I still got plenty of power as far as reaching out. I'm not a big long range guy, you know, 400 or 500 yards about as far as I want to do. I have started contemplating going more of the short action route, you know, as far as like in a 708 or 308, just to cut down on recoil a little bit, get a little bit lighter gun. That's kind of one main advantage there is getting a short action, shorter barrels in terms of backpacking.
Yeah.
Such a weight Nazi on everything that I pack, you know. Granted, my long action rifle now is fairly light, but yeah, I think I'm a big 284 caliber fan anyways.
Yep, I have to agree. Shooting a 280 Ackley right now, so
yeah.
Just picked up a 6.5 by a 6.5 300 Weatherby.
That thing's a hot rod.
Hey, I'm looking forward to getting that race car out of the garage and taking it for a spin here. Elk, mule deer, or antelope?
Oh man, it's a toughie. I there's nothing like hunting elk in September, but like I said at the beginning, last couple of years I've really been getting turned on to mule deer, particularly like in the late rifle seasons for the rut. I am planning on here in a couple of years I'm going down to Wyoming and doing an early bow hunt down there. Kind of get a taste of that. We don't get too much like that high alpine stuff here in Montana. We just don't have the elevation for it. But I think out of those three, I think right now I have to go mule deer.
Nice. What is your dream hunt?
Oh, that's a toughie. I knew that one was coming too because I thought about it the other day. man, I think I would probably either have to go with tar or chamois in New Zealand or stone sheep hunt.
One state the rest of your life. You could only hunt one state the rest of your life. Which state would it be?
Montana. Definitely. I mean, I know that, you know, man, it's hard to explain. I know that there's probably arguably somewhat better hunting in other states. I do think that there's better management practices in other states. But it's really hard to argue a 6-week archer season and a 5-week gun season.
What would you say is your most essential piece of backcountry hunting gear? Obviously, like your weapon system not included.
I would say probably optics. I do a lot of glassing as far as later in the year. You know, and that's actually the biggest thing I look forward to as far as when it comes to rifle hunting, is just finding a good spot to sit down and glass. You know, we get into some pretty gnarly areas. Once we get there, I like just sitting down and feeling it out.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, where can, well, let me ask you this. Do you want people to find you after after this
totally
podcast?
Fine.
No, you
yeah,
do.
I mean, yeah.
Dave, let's see on Instagram, Dave_Barnett with 2 T's _. Is
yep.
that
yeah,
kind of your preferred deal or?
Yeah, definitely. That's where I spend most of the time as far as social media is concerned. It'd be the quickest I can get back to you. You know, that's one thing I want to say. I mean, this is such a big topic, you know, and I mean, it could go on for hours as far as just discussing different parameters, you know, and that's one thing. If anybody has any questions or suggestions or anything, you know, I definitely want to hear them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, just in general, you know, this podcast will always strive to be, a podcast where we're not afraid. You know, we're not going to go into the slums. I don't think we're not going to dive into, you know, things that don't need to be discussed. But at the same time, we're not going to be afraid to, talk about things that are controversial. We're not going to be afraid to, you know, to bring things up that, you know, there's going to be a 50-50 split on, and we'll do our best to lay kind of the situation out and the facts. Anyone who knows me knows I'm definitely not afraid to share my opinion. I will try to keep that relatively to myself, you know, unless it's a strong conviction or something that really matters. But man, I agree. I appreciate people, you know, giving me feedback on the podcast. So I'm sure you're okay, you know, hearing. You know, good quality, constructive feedback on your articles and stuff like that. And this one's
yep.
probably no different.
Exactly.
So there, and then if they haven't read the article, it's on Go Hunt. Do they have to be an insider to read that or?
Nope. That's a free article there.
Freebie, man. Getting a free free podcast, free article. We give away free gear all the time. This is a lovely world we live in. So.
Oh yeah.
GoHunt.com. It's probably been what 3 weeks now. They might have to search back 5 or 6 or 8 articles, maybe.
Yeah, I think it's still showing up on the homepage. And when you go to, they have a section on the website for articles, and it's broke down into different sections. I think if you click on the life, is the section that this article will be listed under.
Cool. All right, Dave. One final question, but first I want to give you credit. Definitely want to give you credit for, you know, just being a successful backcountry hunter. I didn't know about you, before this, and, you know, it doesn't take long scrolling through your feed to realize that, you know, you're one of us, you're a guy that hunts the backcountry and, you know, not just the fact that you kill stuff, but, you know, you just looks like you, you like to get into the backcountry and that's all that really matters. I want to give you credit for being a family man, looking at little pictures, scrolling through and got some pictures of your daughter and stuff. And it looks like one here where you guys are blowing on an elk. Is that an elk bugle that your daughter's looking at
yep.
you blowing? Yeah. So congratulations on that and for being a family man and you know, being able to set aside time to do things like write articles and stuff like that. And last, I want to give you credit for not being afraid to write an article on a controversial topic. You know, it's one thing that I struggle with. I think more than other things is, you know, these controversial topics come up maybe on social media, and I generally choose to just stay out of it. Not that I don't have an opinion, but there's certain topics and there's certain issues I believe that, you know. We need to be able to stand up, you know, and speak our mind and have some conviction about things in life. I can't remember who the quote is, but it's, you know, the one that we've all heard. The only thing that has to happen for, and I'm going to butcher it, but the only thing that has to happen for bad things to happen is for good men to do nothing. Maybe you know that
right.
better than I do, but, so thanks for at least stepping into the, you know, onto the court and being willing to share your opinion and present controversial topics.
Yeah, heck yeah. And I just appreciate the pl- platform, you know, be able to get on and talk about it a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely something like I said, I think, you know, past the article and, you know, I think we discovered just in talking, you know, it's a subject that can be really chewed on and mulled over for quite a while.
Yeah. And that's good. You know, it's not a bad thing to mull over topics and have our discussions and learn different points of view. So
right.
Thank you for coming on. What, one last question here. Why do you hunt the backcountry?
Oh man. It, like I said, it's the feeling when you get back to the truck after a successful hunt. You know, there's definitely easier ways to, I think, to fill tags than what we normally do here. You know, we're hunting some pretty nasty spots sometimes, and you know, they don't feel good to get into all the time. But you know, when you can find an animal doing animal things and not, you know, not something that was influenced by, you know, an act of man, whether it be spooking them or whatever. You know, but just to see an animal doing what they normally would in natural world, and then to outsmart them in that country. And then to turn around and, you know, and go through all the pain it takes to get one out of it. There's nothing like it.
Perfect. Dave, thank you so much for taking the time and for coming on and, you know, taking time away from your family and whatever else you had going on tonight and yesterday night for that matter, because I botched it. So thanks twice. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And thanks again for the opportunity, Justin. I really appreciate it.
Hey, no problem, man. I'm sure we'll be in touch, and I'm following you now, so I'll be keeping an eye on what you got going on. So
wonderful.
Okay. Have a good night, Dave. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Finding Backcountry podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe and mention it to your friends. But the best thing you can do, leave a rating on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. For notes and links to this and other episodes, please visit findingbackcountry.com.